What did you have for breakfast today?
Three hard-boiled eggs and a protein ball.
Three hard-boiled eggs and a protein ball.
I want to slap myself in the face.
Lots of balls. Love it. This podcast is brought to you by Morale Media. Are you an entrepreneur or maybe a marketer who wants to grow their business through content production? Maybe you're sick of dealing with agencies or want an outsourced solution that actually fits a budget? Well, Morale Media, our business, can help you with simple and affordable content production, saving you time and money by taking away that pain of producing the content. If you want to learn more, just head to neural.com/media, which is NEURALLE.com/media. Play around with our pricing, have a look at all the different options that you have, request or consider requesting a callback from me personally. If you have a friend that runs a business or is a marketer, do send them our way. It will help us keep the lights on and producing more juicy content. Listeners to this show receive a special discount by using the promo code UNCOMMON. If you want to learn yourself as to how to create content, maybe you want to make a podcast or your very own video, just download our free series on how to create a podcast and video at the very bottom of neural.com/media. Welcome to another episode of Uncommon, the podcast that helps you build your knowledge, skills, and mindset through interviews with unique individuals. My name's Jordan Michaelides, and I'm your host. In this episode, I've got for you Greg Sanderson. Greg is a cocktail bartender, co-founder, and national operations manager of the Speakeasy Group, and easily one of Australia's most prominent bar operators. The Speakeasy Group owns a range of stunning venues in Melbourne and Sydney both, including Eau de Vie, Mjolnir, Nick and Nora's, and Boilermaker House. Greg has indirectly had a major impact on so many people in the industry, from waiters to bartenders to chefs. We all respect the level he holds himself accountable to, making us want to be better in the process. And I remember first meeting Greg at a Diageo training event way back in my hospitality days, and you could clearly see that he was a man that had an unbridled seriousness for creating amazing experiences, whether it's innovating through crowdfunding raises or opening iconic institutions, rather, like Eau de Vie. Greg and his business partner Sven continue to excite us all. This was a great episode where we discuss the politics of lemon lime bitters, falling in love with hospitality, the Speakeasy Group and its venues, managing stress in the industry, trends he'd like to see go away and what hasn't changed, and Melbourne's passion for cocktails as well. If you enjoyed this episode, subscribe on your podcast app or leave us a rating as well. Show notes, including this episode and all previous guests, can be found at neural.com/podcast. That's NEURALLE.com/podcast. Thank you so much for listening, our regulars for coming back, and newbies for giving us a shot. I hope you all enjoy this conversation with Greg Sanderson. Greg, thanks for joining me.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Now, we had a good little chat before, and I was thinking, geez, what can I do for like an icebreaker question? I always like to sort of get the guest in some way at first. And one of the big things I noticed on the Bartender Exchange was the politics of lemon lime bitters. Now, many people who haven't worked in hospo think, oh, lemon lime bitters, that's the thing I grew up on, other than Coke and lemonade when they went to restaurants as kids. Can you explain the whole politics of lemon lime bitters, why people dislike it in bars and all that sort of stuff?
Yeah, well, Well, essentially, the bitter element is from Angostura bitters, and it's 44.7% alcohol content. So it is an alcoholic beverage, but it's not classified as such. It's classified as a food additive.
Okay.
Now, there is no kind of, specifications on how much to put in a drink. So some bartenders may be more heavy-handed and then create a drink that, you know, is somewhat alcoholic. And it is a drink that's quite acceptable to give to children. Now, I mean, I've never had an issue serving up a child lemon lime bitters, but I do put a one to two, maybe three drops on the top. There are no cocktails. Trinidad Sour actually has 30 mils of Angostura bitters in the drink. Very different story, but I think that's... I haven't seen the thread on the bartender exchange you're talking about, but...
Well, I feel like it was something like... people were pissed off about... or get pissed off about having to create them because they froth up or... something like that. I don't know what it is, but like I've like refound... I found it so funny because I've just refound... my partner, she bought some bitters because we've been trying to make some cocktails at home. You might have seen the vermouth down there. We've been making Negronis and sours and all that sort of stuff. And I don't know why she got the Angostura bitters. Maybe she was like, oh, I want to have a lemon lime bitters at home. And I can understand because it really does froth that thing up.
Well, maybe it was a test of like there was an old saying that a bottle of Angostura bitters should last your entire marriage and relationship. So maybe she was seeing how how long it would last.
Wow.
Yeah, I tend to not look at the Melbourne Bartender Exchange too much anymore because it makes me angry watching some of these threads, which is probably why I haven't seen it.
I've got to be careful not to laugh because I only recently joined it. When I told my friend that I was interviewing you, and he's like, oh, you should get on the Bartender Exchange, ask some questions, people will love it. Have a look at some of the threads, and it's quite funny. It's just sort of very niche memes about working in the very specific world of bars.
It makes me mad and it makes me feel old because I feel like shaking my hand in the air like an old man, and back in my day, you didn't bitch about this kind of stuff.
It's definitely true though, but... it's one of those things that I sort of learned the hard way in hospitality, that it's sort of the easy way out to complain about customers, but the better way out is to give them respect in a way. And you can see that in the exchange group, that there's always someone whinging about some sort of customer. But
one of my pet hates, and that's one of the primary reasons I ignore it, and our staff... specifically in told not to ever publicly bitch about customers while they're working for us.
Yeah, well, it's interesting you say that because I remember working at the Press Club Group, and Angie G, the old general manager who now runs Apoca and Alaros restaurants, and she called me once complaining about a customer. Like, I remember I had like this... the back section of the Press Club is a massive section. I don't know why they didn't just split it in two, but it was like 40 people versus the standard 25 for your standard section. Mm-hmm. And at the Press Club, when you're generally doing like 8-10 courses, like that's just... it was insane.
A lot of running.
So they'd always put like the fittest person back there, and I seemed to just get the short stick every time. And one night I was just having a bad night and I was complaining. I was at the station and Angie like pulled me aside and she's like, you ever fucking say that again, I'll fire you. And she like gave me this whole like speech and why we don't do that and all that sort of stuff. And it's sort of really, you know, we had this philosophy of philodemo, which is like respect and humility in Greek. And it was that sort of moment she really instilled that into me. And I noticed that you've spoken about that in interviews as well, that focus on service and so forth.
Most certainly. I mean, that's why we go out. Like, you can go to a Dan Murphy's and buy a bottle of Tanqueray, a bottle of vermouth and a bottle of Campari and go home and make Negronis to your heart's content. But we go out for an experience. We go out for the service, you know, and we have to respect that. Like, you know, I don't want to rag on the Bartender Exchange too much, but because I do love it as well.
It's a great group. Yeah, I'd agree.
But then, like, the complaints that I commonly see is about having to make drinks that the bartender doesn't want to make. Like, oh, I can't check out this docket for 20 mojitos I had to make. I'm like, man, the great bartenders to me are the people that make a perfect mojito the first time, a perfect mojito like 5 minutes before close, and a perfect mojito whether they like it or not. And they're proud of the 20 that they put up. They don't go onto a social forum and kind of bitch about having to make these 20 mojitos and what's wrong with a mojito. It's a great drink.
Yeah.
So they're the ones that I kind of like don't like. And that's why I call it a bit of a pet hate, because, you know, you're paying customers, you know, and they want 20 mojitos, they can get 20 of the best mojitos if you ask me.
Yeah. Well, that was one of the things you said in that interview is people are coming to see you and it's a luxury. Like, it's a very special thing to go to a bar like Eau de Vie. It's not like, you know, people... I'm sure you get regulars, but You know, I'm sure you get a lot of people that are there for like a 21st birthday or a 50th or 60th or something like that. Or maybe they're just waiting to go to Chin Chin afterwards.
Well, it's, you know, everyone's got an income and everyone has to budget out their income. Some are better than others. And you know, you've got your rent, your food bills, your essentials. And then you've got this small, really small sometimes, chunk of money that you get to play with.
Yeah.
And when you walk into one of our venues or walk into any bar or restaurant, that's that small little bit of money that you're allowed to, you're allowing yourself to spend on luxury, whether it's just a cocktail or a meal or bottle of champagne. And that's a special industry to be in. I love being there. You know, it's not like I'm a dentist where someone's swearing about seeing me and spending their money. And I think everyone in the industry has to understand that and really love it for what it is.
Who taught you that? That was the first thing that came to mind. Like, was there a mentor that you had that really drilled that into your head, or did you just believe that from the start?
I'd like to say I've believed it from the start. You know, I've been kind of bartending since almost I turned 18. I've learned a lot of lessons over the years. And I've had a lot of mentors. I wouldn't say, apart from my current business partner, Sven, he's been there for the last decade. I've had a lot of mentors along the way, but it's also, I've learned a lot of lessons from, you know, maybe I was that young, arrogant bartender at some stage, and I've kind of checked myself along the way. What are you thinking, Greg? You know better than these people to hate a mojito.
That's interesting. Yeah. So you sort of feel that it's sort of accumulated in a way over time.
Most certainly.
And it's something that you fought in your own head.
I think a lot of, especially I talk, you know, bartenders, but chefs as well, people in the industry, a lot of people will get to a certain stage and they know how to mix a bourbon with some vermouth and put bitters in, and they think they're a genius, and they stop. They think that they're, you know, solving some kind of, you know, big life issues or something for people, and they get a big head and an ego, and the bartenders and the chefs that will actually become great will realize it's not about them, it's about the guest. And I think every great person in hospitality has to get to that stage at some stage, some earlier than others, and some won't move past it.
Yeah,
they're the ones I don't really like getting served by sometimes.
Yeah, I can imagine. Are there like leaders over the years that you really, like, I know you spoke about Sven, but I can imagine myself, because when I got into the field of commerce and finance, there's people I've really looked up to, whether it's through books, documentaries, whatever it may be, and I've started to embody the principles that they have. Mm-hmm. And it sort of sounds like you obviously were influenced by people like Sven, but mm-hmm. working through it in your own head, there may have been... get this fucking phone. There may have been, you know, people that influenced you along the way through books or documentaries in some way. Is that the case?
Yeah, I mean, I've always kind of been pretty big on self, working on myself and doing it through books. Like back in the early days of being a bartender, I wanted to be the best bartender I could be. And then, so I just read every book I could possibly get my hands on, whether it was about vermouth, spirits, cocktails, bartending, history, the 1980s cocktails that we want to forget. I read a lot and took a lot away from those books. And now that I'm an operations manager and a business owner, I've switched to books about leadership, listening to podcasts about leadership. Uh-huh. So I've always kind of read, that's been quite common throughout my career. In the way of people, I think everyone is kind of, I've tried to take inspiration from everyone I've worked with. I think even the people that I don't look up to, I've learned from them and the elements of their personality and what they've done that I don't want to be like that. I think if you start out thinking about what kind of hospitality professional you would like to be, or even a in life where you want to be, you can pick out elements from different people that you admire and other elements that you don't admire, and kind of then form your own personal opinions and style.
Yeah, I mean, that just had me thinking, this starts to make a lot of sense in some of the things that you've done now, because I don't know if you consider yourself like an innovator, but you've done some interesting things for the industry that other people would label as innovative.
It's been pretty fun.
Yeah, whether it's degustations or the recent capital raise with Birchall or the mentor program as well. Now, you spoke about people outside of industry and leadership and so forth. Are there any, do you think there are any particular principles or books that have had a real formative impact on you at all in the last few years?
Principles? I mean, it's more like a quote from Winston Churchill that grit is one of the most underrated kind of qualities that for a successful life, you know, not intelligence or good positioning and from breeding or kind of luck or anything, but just plain out grit. And that's something I like to think I have. You know, I've always kind of had, for a long time, had multiple jobs, worked almost full time throughout university. If I'm having a bad day, just suck it off and keep going, you know. I think that's something that's kind of really stuck with me.
Yeah,
it's just the grit. So the days that you kind of want to just hide away and go, oh man, it's all a bit too hard, you just
keep going,
keep pushing.
But also it seems that you have like a general idea that you want to be constantly learning, like whether it's reading books that are outside or
and from everybody, like I was gonna say before, throughout, like I've been bartending for 19 years or working in the hospitality industry for even longer if you count KFC. I think it's the, I'd like to think that I'm not arrogant enough to think that I can learn from everybody. I can learn things from the glassy, from the person washing the dishes, from the people that are my leaders at the time or my bosses. If you have an open mind that everyone has something to teach you, you really will spend a life of learning.
Yeah. It makes me think about like one of the key questions that people were asking about was trends and your ability to predict and so forth. But I want to come back to that, more of the industry stuff a little bit later, because I'm also thinking about how you even got into this. Like I know that reading a prior interview, you decided around 18 that, you know, you wanted to work in dark bars for the rest of your life. what do you think was like the catalyst? Like where did you go like, this is really what I want to do?
I think that, I mean, I just said KFC. I started working at KFC in my hometown when I was about 14 and a half, I think. Mm-hmm. Almost the month it became legal to take a job.
Where did you work? Where did you grow up?
Nambour, Sunshine Coast, about 100 kilometers north of Brisbane. And just kind of fell in love with the interaction with the guests, the front of house or the back of house, the cooking. And I worked at KFC up until I was 18 and then got a job for a bar, an English pub, actually.
Wow. And this is in the same place, Nambour?
No, English pub was in Brisbane. But
okay.
And then I started to study a Bachelor of Business at Sunshine Coast University.
Okay.
And then transferred that to a Bachelor of International Business major in Hotel and Tourism Management in Brisbane at St. Lucia, University of Queensland.
Okay.
So then I took the route of saying, well, I fall in love with hospitality. It's what I want to do. You know, if the formal education's not the route most people take. Most people get into hospitality doing a degree in something other than hospitality, work throughout their degree and just get to the end of it. And, you know, I love hospitality, but I decided pretty early on that it was what I wanted to do. And then went down the formal route and then worked in everything from English pubs, restaurants, nightclub style service, cafes, cocktail bars. Yeah. It's back in, you know, that long ago, it was the only way to, you know, you couldn't jump out at not being a 19-year-old and say, I want to work in one of the coolest cocktail bars in town. You had to do your time in the trenches.
And when did it sort of materialize that this cocktail bar thing was a real career? Because one of the things I was looking at was the profession. I can imagine when you started out, the profession wouldn't have been as highly respected as what it's become in, say, the last 10 years in particular. So those, like you said, those first years you've been slogging it out at cafes, restaurants, bars, and so forth. When did it sort of become like, I'm a cocktail bartender, I'm doing competitions, I'm becoming head bartender at Black Pearl, where me and my mate Johnny are like, oh, Greg Sanderson's down at the Black Pearl, let's go down to the Black Pearl.
Yeah.
When did it become, what was that journey from jumping around in those different types of venues to that point then?
Yeah, after I graduated university, I, funnily enough, actually got the job as the general manager of the university bar at St. Lucia called the Red Room. The Red Room was run by the student union, and I think it was a 24 at the time. 24 at the time. And I got the job and I came in, and because it was an on-campus bar, it had to close for an hour of the day. Kick all the students out so they wouldn't just sit there in the bar all day. And we weren't allowed to do any drink specials. So you couldn't advertise happy hours or things like this, and so forth. So what I did is I basically made this list of 21 cocktails that were dirt cheap to get the, you know, get the students in. And then the, you know, the authorities at the university would come in and see a table of 20 rugby union boys all sitting there sipping on cocktails with umbrellas in them, because a Long Island iced tea was $8. And then I was like, oh, wow, really? Like, I did it for just to draw in a crowd. And then I was like, wow, this cocktail thing is pretty cool. Started doing a bit of research, mostly into the cocktails that the students liked. Definitely a lot of blended cocktails. We were burning through a blender almost a week. We were doing so many cocktails. I think we were doing like 50 liters of pineapple juice a week. And I started reading about the cocktails that we should be serving in this bar. It kind of, the passion grew, and I realized the drinks that we were making were pretty, you know, pretty dated and average in the way of the world of cocktails. And then I moved to Scotland, and my goal at moving to Scotland was like, I'm just going to find the best cocktail bar I could possibly find, and I'm going to get a job there.
Why Scotland? Why not New York as an example?
Well, it's kind of like that time getting a visa in the UK was a lot easier. So we did that 2-year UK visa. Most people I knew, most Australians, were doing it in London. And I just had this feeling that London wasn't for me. And I knew a couple of people who lived in Scotland. So moved up to Scotland. And after seeing London, I 100% agreed with my intuition that it wasn't for me. London is so large. It becomes like a small town. So when I first got there, I called friends up and I'm like, hey, I'm in town. Let's meet up. They're like, oh, you're on the red line, bro. No way. I'm like, but I've just traveled the other side of the world. Edinburgh. So I moved to Edinburgh, and it's like this nice community. You know, it's a central kind of CBD.
It's a beautiful city. It's absolutely amazing.
Gorgeous. And walking to and from work every day around the castle.
Holyrood Park.
From Princess Street Gardens and so forth, is something that I'll always remember.
Yeah, I remember when we stayed there probably August of 2012, and I remember we got there probably late afternoon, and then we got to our apartment and I was just absolutely wrecked, and the sun was like sitting down, and our apartment that we'd rented through Airbnb was like right on the back of Holyrood Park. Like, you walk out the back door of the backyard and it's there. And like, what's the mountain... Arthur's Seat was literally 500 to maybe 700 meters.
You climb up it?
Yeah, we went up it. It's
beautiful.
It's just amazing that you can have that right next to that city, like that old town. You lived in Edinburgh.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you lived there for how long?
Just 2 years.
And then you came back here, and then that's when you went hard.
I got a job as at a cocktail bar in Scotland, and they had this amazing training program. So the company was called Montpellier's Group, and the bar that I was working at was called Opera Lounge. Before you even started on the bar, they took you away for a couple of days of training of all things wine, spirits, cocktails, every few months, I forget what the timing was, you would go back for more training. And it was the training that I received working for the Montpellier's Group in Scotland, which gave me a passion for training in general. And then I eventually came back to Australia and got involved in a training program for bartenders here as well. But it's the training that I got there that I really absolutely loved. Worked in a cocktail bar on George Street, the Opera Lounge. And I think I entered my first cocktail competition within the first 2 or 3 months of working there.
Right.
And won it. Now, that's probably what kickstarted everything that came after, because if I lost that cocktail competition, who knows how it would have gone. But I won it, and I was like, wow, you know, maybe there's something in this.
Maybe I'm good at this.
Maybe I'm good at this. Maybe I was just lucky on the day. and then started, you know, entering more cocktail competitions and more, and came back to Australia. I'd never been to Melbourne before I moved here, but so many people from Scotland move to Melbourne, and it's like this little sister city. Edinburgh and Melbourne share so many,
really,
so many people, especially within the hospitality industry. So a few people that I was working with in Scotland said, wow, you'd really like Melbourne. I'm like, okay, I trust you.
Okay. Well, the climate's sort of similar, though. It's a little bit colder in Edinburgh.
Yeah, a little bit colder, but still just as dreary through winter.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
There's a few things I want to pick up on there. That it was interesting about the Red Room thing. It seems like that was the moment where you, A, not only enjoyed the reception that you would get from people enjoying themselves. You know, that's sort of where that service element comes from. And I think a lot of people in hospitality have that. You've got to seek enjoyment yourself from other people's having enjoyment.
Mm.
Would you agree with that?
Yeah. I don't think we should be in this industry unless you do.
Yeah. I think that for me, you've got to be a naturally extroverted person who really thrives off people having fun.
Mm.
But, you know, because of you, essentially. And then also that sort of hustle element, the fact that you were making, like, for context, the audience probably wouldn't, I mean, I'm sure that people have had or heard of a Long Island iced tea before, but what, they're like a $30 drink, $25 drink these days?
Yeah.
At a standard
not
bar?
Not cheap. I think we're making them almost with full shots of booze as well.
So you must have been using cheap booze, or at least
it was
cost
a university.
Price.
It was a university bar. I think we used to get our, not that a bourbon goes in a Long Island iced tea, but I think we were getting it in like 25 litre. Plastic containers.
Oh my God.
I'm not going to mention the brand.
Jesus. But also that training thing seems like and your time at Opal Lounge seems important, because that sort of ignited that excitement and the flair element.
Most certainly. And you were talking about mentors before. I think I probably have a few within that company. The training manager who can manage the training school, I'm gonna get his last name wrong. I'll get back to his last name. Is now, I think, the head trainer for Bacardi US.
Mm-hmm.
So he kind of followed his training roots, passion as well, and now he's a big kind of training or advocacy manager within Bacardi. So he kind of left there, and then there was Andrew Coyle, who was my bar manager at the time. Just loads of experience, cocktail bar. Like, these guys were just nerdy about booze.
Yeah.
And I was just jealous of how much they knew. That's why I read and read and read. I think, you know, over the years I've seen a lot of people that will get a job in a good bar, and they just assume that by working next to someone that's good, they're going to soak knowledge through their pores, and they don't understand that it requires a lot of work on your own.
Yeah.
And that's what they kind of inspired in me. Like, hey, every time I had a question, they're like, cool, I'll answer that question, but here's a book that you can...
This is what you should go read, yeah.
Go, if you're interested in that, go read that book, and I would go read that book. So they kind of inspired me to, I guess, you know, once again... focus on you know, yourself and putting some effort into your own knowledge.
The thing about the bar scene, you were saying before that a lot of people from Edinburgh or Scotland would go to Melbourne. I feel like because we're so privileged here in Melbourne with the fact that the local hospitality scene is at, like, really focused on locals for a start. Like, we don't rely on tourists like Sydney does. But also people have a very, very high level of quality. And so we seem to produce a lot of bar stars, so to speak.
Oh, you might be mistaken. Melbourne, the hospitality scene relies on Kiwis and Queenslanders.
Really? someone said this. I know Kiwis, definitely in like restaurants, Kiwis.
Kiwis, Queenslanders, maybe not as many backpackers as Sydney, but...
But the fact that we were able to create that platform is interesting to me. And it sort of just had me think about where are sort of the bar... capitals, you know, if you were to go 1 to 5 in the world, how would you rattle them off?
You know, I'm gonna be biased in there's London, New York, Melbourne, Edinburgh,
Singapore, maybe
in the very yes, like I think some of the bars are amazing in Singapore. Like, I haven't been, it's been a while since I've been to Singapore, and it's probably gonna make my top five, but if you talk to people, I think I was talking to someone that worked for Kettle One Vodka once, and he said that there's so many amazing cocktail markets around the world, but what's happening in those markets is there's amazing cocktail bars, there's amazing cocktail bartenders, but the guests still walk in and order wine. the special thing that happens in Melbourne is that the consumers, the general public, love, have this huge passion for cocktails. So you've got this great melting pot of great cocktail bars, great cocktail bartenders, and a population that can't get enough of them.
Right.
So that's why Melbourne for me is special. London's always kind of pushed the barriers. New York's just one of those, it's just got some great talent. And, you know, the bars that kind of sparked the second, this current golden age of cocktails have come out of New York. I guess Singapore would be there. I'm struggling to find my fifth. I'll walk out of this and go, God.
I was just thinking, like, is there a city that, like, has cropped up lately that people are talking about, like, these leading bars and bartenders that exist in it? But I think you hit it the nail on the head, and I think that goes back to you as an individual, is that the focus on the customer. The customers, I would 100% agree, here in Melbourne are very willing to try new things. And yes, just you can notice that when you're traveling a lot, you know, you can just see, particularly in places in the West, you know, I find like in America, sometimes people are less willing to try things. It's sort of like the classic, you know, give me a mojito or a rosé or stuff like that. But I would agree, it's people are very, very engaging here.
Mm, I think it comes out of Melbourne's just love of wine first, like as a beverage.
But it's part of an identity as well.
Yeah, you know, trying new things, like that, the new bars, the new restaurants, the new wines, the new gins.
Well, I went to O2B on the weekend.
Yeah, I worked at Gin Palace when I first moved to Melbourne for a few months. Yeah. And the one thing that I kind of understood when I got there was, I mean, Gin Palace has been around, you know, 15, 20 years now. I can't even remember. When I was working in the UK, people would come in and they would say, I would like my vodka martini. Have you got anything that's rye-based? I want my martini dry with this many olives. They'd be very, very specific. But when I asked, when they were ordering wine, they'd just get white, red, I don't care.
Yeah.
Come back to Australia, people are asking for their martinis, just vodka or gin. You know, not too much kind of further than that. But when they asked about their wines, they would be, you know, very, something late harvest. Have you got anything from this vineyard? and over the last, you know, years that I've been working in Melbourne and seen more cocktail bars open up, obviously then there's more bartenders educating guests and so forth. Now the martini orders and the spirit orders are very, very particular. But that for me is just kind of followed how a lot of people in Melbourne have been ordering their wine for so long. Mm-hmm. Being very, very particular about what they like, what they know, and now that's just moved almost seamlessly into, well, coffee, spirits, and everything else that goes along with it.
Yeah, beer had its massive phase in the last 10 years, although I remember when I was finishing up at my old workplace and we were looking at just general trends in alcohol, I think that what was changing, like beer was definitely on the decline. As this sort of health conscious phase was moving through, beer was on the decline. There was, you know, a lot of these micro pubs and breweries were being bought out by Lion Nathan or someone like that. So it's definitely like, I feel like that stage has petered out and now it's all about like healthy organic wine and going to like a cocktail bar that does vegan cocktails. I remember we were like doing some sort of analysis that came up with this sort of stuff, but I can definitely see it's moving more towards that sort of stuff because in the short term, at least, people deem it as healthier.
Yeah, and low alcohol cocktails and non-alcoholic cocktails have had a big kind of boost in the last couple of years. You know, we never used to list our non-alcoholic cocktails in the venues. And now we've got in our restaurants for a list of great non-alcoholic options. And in our eau de vie cocktail bar venues, throughout the list, I think we've got 45 cocktails on the list and all the drinks that can be served without alcohol, but the same flavor profile, the same serve indicated on the menu. So you can have that same experience. You can have the look rather than just getting a highball of juice and a cherry on top for the non-alcoholic option.
Glorified mocktail.
Why, you know, the people you're sitting with are having these amazing shows and well thought out drinks. That's what we're trying to do now.
Okay.
But there's a demand for it and that's what's followed.
Yeah. We're talking before about what makes a great bartender. And I think in what I was tapping into in that last interview, you said, first and foremost, you must be a fantastic host. And we've covered that service element. But I couldn't help but think if you know, with the mentor program at Speakeasy, if you were like sort of if you had the opportunity to create your Franken bartender, what are sort of the elements or characteristics that you'd mixed together in a little perfect cocktail mixer, and out comes your perfect bartender. What would it be?
All right, good question. I would say the hosting skills of a flight attendant or a first class flight attendant, the speed of a nightclub bartender, the ability to make someone feel at home, like a section waiter. I don't know, like I was saying before, like in my day, now I do really sound old, the cocktail bar, if you wanted to work in a cocktail bar, you really had to have done your time in the trenches, because there was only a few cocktail bars in town or around the country even, and you would have to, you know, they were pretty selective in who they'd hire. So you had to kind of go work in a cafe. You'd have to go work in a nightclub. You'd have to go work in a restaurant. You'd have to learn how to pull a pint of beer. Like, you know, working in a pub, it builds your conversation skills with a guest. You have to sit there and, like, you know, pretend that you love sports that, you know, you may not like, just because you're getting in on their conversation, and ask people about their day rather than just talking about you and the drink that you're making.
Yeah.
So I guess the Franken bartender is probably like what I call the well-rounded bartender that has probably done time in these venues. Like in, you know, even in the cocktail bars that we own now, and when I visit cocktail bars, when it's three deep on the bar, you can look down the bar and you can tell who's worked in a nightclub before. And when it's busy on the floor, you can tell who's worked the tables before and so forth. But without, you know, taking all of that out of it, it is the personality that is the big one for me. And
yeah,
you mentioned the mentor program that we've put in place at the Speakeasy Group. We're solely looking for a great personality that we can train skills.
Yeah. You said that in the prior interview, or maybe it was in the release about it, that above all, personality matters most, you know.
Pretty hard to teach a great personality. It's easier to teach the skills.
Yeah. Yeah, with that mentor program, that was one of the innovative things that I was talking about. Where did this idea come from? Like, what drew you to that? Is it that you really wanted to be able to craft talent to help run future venues? Or is it because it's very unique? Like, it sort of reminds you of like a graduate program at like an accounting firm or an advertising firm, like really training up future leaders, so to speak.
There's very little kind of formal training for bartenders. We did this for a couple of reasons. There's very small amounts of formal training for bartenders. And we thought that if someone came through and we put a curriculum to it, and they learned all of these skills working for now a known bar and hospitality group, at the end of it, it would be something that would be very recognizable on their resume. And they could use it to go off to bigger and greater things, or they could continue to grow with us. We also wanted to become a company that people wanted to work for and have these cool opportunities. That's one of our goals. It's always been one of our goals, but it's kind of something we've seriously stepped up in the last couple of years, that, you know, we want to be one of the greatest hospitality companies in the country to work for. We want to take care of our staff in ways that other groups and other venues don't. And part of that's offering some of your staff or new staff these opportunities. I would have loved to have had this opportunity when I was a young hospitality person, working in three different venues, 6 months at each, a set curriculum, three very different venues as well. So we wanted to become, you know, a better known company to work for,
yeah,
and attract kind of the youth and these young people who are going to be the stars tomorrow.
Yeah, well, you're so right. And you've said this in prior interviews, that talent is sort of the thing that drives the business, like in any service business. And I think that just adds that extra layer to your own business in ensuring that it can remain there and become an institution in the long term by creating pathways. That's such an important part of it.
I mean, for years, people have come through the Speakeasy Group and gone on to, and even behind bars, Sven's company before the Speakeasy Group, have come through and gone on to these great things. Like, you know, we've got people that have worked for us that have gone on and opened their own bars, managed huge brands, become global brand ambassadors. We love it when people come through our company and go and they use us as a stepping stone. We do everything we can to help them along the way. When we do staff appraisals or management appraisals, I always ask, where do you want to be in the next 5 years? Hmm. With its, whether it's with us or without us, how can I help you get there? If you want to open your own import company, like how can I help? You know, maybe we've got some storage space at one of our venues that can you can use, not that we have too much storage space, but maybe we can help you in some way to get you started and
encouraging people.
We've had that conversation with quite a few staff, and we've got a lot of cool stuff coming in the near future with staff as well.
Oh, that's great. That's really good. I think it's one of those industries that has stayed very like same, or apart from trends, you know, trends in bars and stuff like that, these operating models. And, you know, this goes back to you keeping an outside view of other forms of leadership in other industries. Mm. These sounds like things that happen at tech companies. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, all of the books I've read about leadership, none of it's based in the hospitality industry.
Yeah, I can imagine.
it's the corporate world, it's IT. Sven's also, he's joined an organization called EO.
Really? Entrepreneurs Org, yeah?
Yeah. And yeah. He's loving that. He's taking a lot out of it. He recently went to some kind of seminars and talks in the US. And it's all, you know, tech people and people in developers, and you talk to them about what they're doing in their company. You know, you talked about our equity raise.
With Birchall
that we're doing at the moment. You know, we must have talked to so many different people about how they've raised equity in their business, how they've valued their business, when to raise equity, when not to, and so forth. And nobody we've talked to has really been in the hospitality industry.
Yeah, no one's done this. Not in OSPO.
Not in Australia.
Yeah.
And not for a group. There's been a bar group in the UK. There's been a lot of craft breweries doing it, with BrewDog being the kind of the poster child of equity raising at the moment. And then there's a few in Australia. Black Ops out of Queensland's just done it. And Endeavour have also taken it on as well.
Yeah. This reminds me, I want to jump into the Speakeasy group now.
Hmm.
I was picking through things, and it's one of those things, sometimes you find like a little section on someone's website and you just get lost looking at menus and all that sort of stuff. So right now you've got Eau de Vie, Melbourne and Sydney.
Mm-hmm.
You got Boilermaker House, Nick and Nora.
Mm-hmm.
Is it Mjolnir?
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Yeah?
Yeah. Thor's Hammer.
Yeah. So Thor's Hammer in Melbourne.
And Sydney.
Mm-hmm. What's the venue in Parramatta?
That's Nick and Nora's.
Okay. What was, obviously Eau de Vie was the first, but what was the general thesis? Like, did you go into this thinking, I just want to start my own venue? Or did you go into it thinking, I want to start a group? How did this sort of snowball into what it is now?
Well, right. Like most kind of people working in the bar industry, I guess, or definitely a lot of people working in the bar industry, always wanted to own my own venue. But I think from the get-go, I wanted to own a group, and I get excited about new brands and new concepts and new venues, and just kind of found myself in the position to be able to do that. So I think we kind of called it a group as soon as we could officially call it a group. We branded it Speakeasy Group as soon as it was, I think, more than one venue. At the time I was working as a brand ambassador, and I'd been working as a brand ambassador in Melbourne and around Australia for, I think, 4.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it was time for a change. So I started looking for brand ambassador jobs in other countries. I think I got to the stage where I was accepting a job to work out of India, and that fell through.
What?
And then
out of India?
In Mumbai. And then I was looking at a job in Hong Kong, and that didn't eventuate. And then I just called up Sven, my business partner now. I was like, right, let's open Eau de Vie in Melbourne. And he's like, fucking amazing. Let's do it.
And he was in Sydney at the time?
He is still in Sydney. Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah. And so you opened Eau de Vie. How long after that did the next venue come about?
Years. About 2.5? No, 3 years. 3 years, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So it happened kind of pretty slowly. I worked on the bar for 3 years.
Yeah. So the first 3 years was really where you made your bread and butter, where you essentially refined what the business model would be.
Mm.
you know, what, how the menus would work, how the processes would, you know, it seems like those first few years in any business is really the tough years.
Yeah, I think we had that kind of set before we even opened Eau de Vie. The idea was always to, I mean, we used to owned a training company called Behind Bars.
Okay.
I think over the existence of the business, I always get this wrong. It was around 45,000 to 65,000 bartenders we trained over a couple of years. I think I personally trained around 4,500 to 5,000 bartenders.
Really?
And when we were training, we were training on spirits. We were training on spirits from a simple gin and tonic on how to make a drink to cocktails, working with cocktail competitions, just basically singing the good word of spirits around Australia. The company we work for is Diageo, one of the world's largest spirit company in the world.
Yeah.
And in Australia, they did not see other vodkas and other gins so much as a competitor as they saw beer and wine, because Australians are big beer and wine drinkers, mm-hmm. especially when you go out and you order a gin and tonic. In one venue, it's a perfectly made gin and tonic with plenty of ice and a nice garnish. And you go to the next bar and it's no ice and it tastes like crap. So what do? You fall back to a bottle of beer or a glass of wine.
Okay.
So the idea of training was to basically increase the level of drink production around Australia, like regardless of brand, to pull people into that spirit and drinking kind of category. Now, at the time, even Diageo saw that spirits was something that people turned to at the end of the night, that they would start drinking beer, they would start on the wine, and then they'd get to a certain stage of their night and they would turn to cocktails or spirits. And that's when they wanted to kind of capitalize and get that moment earlier in the night. And opening Eau de Vie was, well, why can't that occasion, the spirit drinking occasion, be the occasion? Why can't it be all night? So that was the idea of opening Eau de Vie, to make spirit the occasion, to make spirits the center of attention.
Yeah.
You know, we had, I think, what, three different beers, four different beers available, a couple of glasses of wine. If you want to choose from a massive selection of beer and wine, do not go to Eau de Vie. If you want a huge selection of spirits and cocktails to choose from, that's where you need to be.
Okay.
And that was the idea. And that's the idea that we've taken to our other venues, that we choose what we want to do and we make sure there's a fantastic offering in that. So if you go to Boilermaker House is a whiskey bar. How do you kind of pull that into being a whiskey bar? Well, you put 1,000 whiskeys on the bar. We want to match it with beer. So what do? We get 12 taps and 50 odd in the packaged and have a selection of 60 beers. It's something that's kind of, and even with Nick and Nora's being a champagne bar, we've got, you know, 70 different champagnes to choose from. And that's kind of like, I think when you said we spent our first years kind of perfecting it, we did perfect it over a couple of years, but it's something we opened the doors to do.
Yeah. And you had intention to do.
Exactly.
Yeah. One of the big questions, or one of the things that was riding in my mind, and particularly when I was reading like that virtual capital raise section and just looking through it, it seems that like in the cocktail, I don't know if I'm misguided here, but in hospitality businesses, on average, margins are a lot higher than your standard business in Australia. I don't know if this is true in the bar business, but like it seems that the business model, because you're essentially taking a raw ingredient, just applying fixtures, fittings and labor and all that sort of stuff, you get like a sort of a higher margin product. Is that true? Or is that the case? Like, is it one of these unique
areas?
No, I'd say
the hospitality business is like you're literally slicing small amounts of money off the top.
Really?
It's not a high margin business, but it's a high volume business. I mean, we do pretty well with our venues in the way of a margin, but it takes a lot of work, and that goes right back to signing a lease, forecasting correctly, you know, looking at how many bodies you can fit in that venue, how many hours of the day you can operate it, what products are you going to be selling, what people will be buying, what's your selling price. I mean, if you look at it just of the ingredients that go into a cocktail and then how much we're selling it for, I mean, labor costs are huge. Like, it's not like someone's just sitting in a massive clothing store and one person can sell $40,000 worth of clothes a day. It's a high kind of production industry. So the margins can be low, and they can also be pretty good, but you need to watch element of the business, like a hawk. And that's where, I guess, you know, you're saying that the hospitality industry is known for having a high profit margin, but it's also known for a lot of people going out of business.
Of course, yeah. And very quick.
And very quickly.
Within a year.
And it is just never stopping watching the numbers. You know, I definitely got into the hospitality industry because I love people and I love, you know, cocktail bartending, and I love being a great host, and I love everything that goes around it. But I've gotten good at becoming an operations manager because I'm also good at numbers.
Yeah. Well, it's that thing you mentioned before about the decision before you even open the venue. Like, that's a very value investing capital allocation decision, because if the general thesis of the business is wrong, and I think so many people get this wrong when they start out in business, they have an idea, but they've not meticulously mapped out whether the pricing model meets the distribution model. Like, are they going to get enough people through the doors? Is it word of mouth? Is it, you know, marketing via Instagram or whatever it is to suit what the average spend is per customer, and how many customers do you need a night? What are you going to get on a Monday or Tuesday night?
Exactly. I've heard of venues opening that will open the doors and then shortly after opening realize that they can't fit enough people in their venue to pay back the fit out costs within their lease period.
Yeah.
And they've, you know, these huge venues. There was one in Melbourne a couple of years ago, huge venue kind of, you know, goes bankrupt and has to sell off because they just can't match, you know, they can't
the spend on the fitting.
The spend and so forth. So, I mean, we try not to keep our methods to ourselves at the Speakeasy Group. All the forecasting that we do prior to opening a venue, we've put out publicly on Australian Bartender Magazine. And if anyone ever calls me up and asks about, you know, advice opening a venue, I've always sat down with them or given them our documents that we use to assist. I would have loved someone to done it for us. we've definitely got help along the way. Like I said before, we ask many, many questions to many, many people about, you know, moving forward with the equity raise we're doing. I forget where we were going with that.
Well, what was curious to me was that fittings thing. That to me seemed like the biggest element. Your decisions on your fixtures and fittings can really, because that's that lump fixed cost that you got to put into straight away.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, for like, what's better, renting a venue that's got a shell, like nothing in there, or a venue that has got stuff in there, but, you know, it's covered in shit.
Well, we've done that. We've done it both ways. We've taken on cold or even warm shells and built from scratch.
Okay.
Where there's literally nothing in the venue, including a power meter or electricity, gas meters. And we've done it the other way, where we've taken on businesses that have gone bankrupt, and we've had to go in and change everything. Each got their advantages. I think every time after we do one, we swear we won't do it, and we'll do it the other way every time. So when we've renovated previously running businesses, we're like, fuck that, let's do it. Let's only take cold shells and warm shells from developers, and then we'll finish one with a developer or from a cold shell. And we're like, fuck that, let's only do it, renovate all venues again. So I think every time we've done a venue, and we've done six now, you know, we try to learn from our mistakes that we've done in the setup. But there's always mistakes. There's always these things like, oh, God damn it, I didn't make that mistake last time, I'm not going to make it. But then something else pops up, you know, whether, you know, even with the first venue I did, it was just a very long learning curve of like going through council and licensing. Oh, if you've spoken to that person, you should have spoken to that person 3 weeks ago. Have you spoken to that person? No. And you start to build a timeline in your head about who to talk to and when to talk to. And then, you know, last time we did we made some lessons, we learned some lessons about who not to hire and who to hire and how to find people. And it's like I said, it's a massive long learning curve.
Yeah. And it's interesting before you mentioned about the developer thing, I've always thought like it would be interesting to see whether you can make more money through deals with like, you know, because recently we used to live up on Spring Street, and there's 35 Spring Street, and they had this venue that just sat empty for ages. I just wonder about that sort of stuff, whether you can sort of work out deals that work out to your benefit, or even like hotels, because a lot of hotel bars are like, you know, they've got a really niche, like this is their really nice bar, and then they've got the lobby bar, And it's sort of like the Gordon Ramsay model in a way, you know, like mm-hmm. he used to go in, the deal was he'd get the restaurant, he'd probably not make much money at all on the restaurant, but he got the food, the room service.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's where they made all their money. I've been thinking about that a lot recently because I go to gym at the Grand Hyatt. they got like an awesome gym there, but I don't know if it works out the same for bars. It'd be pretty hard.
Look, when we had one venue, two venues, even three venues, we never got approached from developers for new sites. I think we get almost one a week now, which is you know, fantastic. There's a lot of opportunities out there, and it's, you know, I think we've become what they call an anchor tenant. Like they want to secure us. and they'll do a good deal with us because then they can tell other people that they've got the speakeasy group bringing a bar in there, and that kind of acts as an anchor to bring in their other tenants. From that, you can get some good deals. But it's also exciting being part of a new location. Like, there's always kind of, I'm not going to say bad juju, but like, you know, if you take over a venue that's been there for some time and people know it and they've, you know, have some associations with it, there's always going to be like, oh, this is that venue that used to be.
This is the old shit place.
Such and such. And, or this is, oh, I used to come here when it was so-and-so. Like, and, you know, oh, it looks pretty cool now, but like, I can still imagine where, like, you know, I was hooking up with that that person like 5 years ago. And when you come into a new development, it's like this fresh, like people have never been there.
It's
clean slate. And you can really do something special. Like, we're currently working with a developer here in Melbourne for our next venue.
Ooh.
And literally shaped the space.
Really?
So they had an open kind of floor plan for the entire floor, and it was all broken up into what they would see as tenancies. And then we sculpted it and said, what if we take these three tenancies but half of that one, and so it's kind of molded into our own kind of a niche kind of four walls, essentially. That's not something that came pre-packaged. Here you go, speakeasy group. Would you like these four walls? They worked with us from the ground up.
Can you speak about what the name of that venue will be?
In Melbourne?
Know? Yeah.
Nick and Norris.
I will be Nick and Norris.
Yes. Okay. Champagne and cocktails, baby.
Okay. Where is it going to be?
The ink's not dry on the lease yet, but okay. It'll be in the Melbourne CBD.
Okay. Interesting. Because I know that you've been speaking about creating another... it's Mjolnir, yeah?
Correct.
Yeah. So where's that next one going to be?
Look, we've had a bit of interest to take it overseas. So we'd love to take that brand overseas. Like, even though it's our most weird and it's a Viking-inspired restaurant.
It really is.
And cocktail bar. So it's, you know, when you tell people it's a Viking-inspired restaurant and cocktail bar, they're like, wow, that's pretty out there. But it's also very commercially successful. Because it's not so in your face themed. We think of it more like an inspired kind of.
It's an aesthetic.
The food is amazing. The drinks are amazing. We just use the kind of like Norse mythology and Viking culture as a backdrop to theme those cocktails and kind of like give you an extra experience on the evening. Hugely, I mean, our Sydney Facebook page has, I think, over 40,000 followers. We did a video with Qantas last year, or Qantas did a video of the venue and just put it on their Australian website. I think it's got 1 million followers on their Facebook site, but the video went out to, I can't even remember now, it was like 20 million people and hundreds of thousands of likes. And so if
the outfit that like the managers are wearing looks very Nordic.
Yeah.
Like, it's just got that Nordic feel.
It's a tunic. But it's made by the original ones we got were from a Norwegian company who turned kind of Viking style, medieval-esque style clothing into modern day streetwear.
Yeah.
And then we put the leather aprons over the top, and some of the staff even strapped knives to their side because, you know, we've got heaps of knives and weapons. I've actually got a license to import, collect weapons.
Right.
Because we had the police walk into Mjolnir, Melbourne and see the swords and the axes on the walls, and they pulled us up, so I had to apply to. So if you need any swords or anything brought in, I got what you need.
If you were to pick a TV show, is it Vikings or Game of Thrones?
What do you make me choose? I'd say I've seen every episode of Vikings, but I've got to say the the excitement for the last season of Game of Thrones coming in is pretty solid.
It's sort of a similar thing. I'm guessing your background is sort of from the UK, right?
No, I'm many generations Australian, but historically, genetically, through England and Europe.
Yeah, because there's sort of, I don't know, that you can see culturally in the northern parts of the United Kingdom, there's a lot of similarities in culture, obviously, because Vikings and so forth used to come and settled in the UK. And so I find like you can see aesthetically similar things in stuff like Game of Thrones and Vikings, although like the time periods are different, it still gives you that same sort of escapism and excitement, whether it's like the worshiping
of the
old
gods. And there was no dragon princesses.
Yeah, no dragon princesses. But like it's interesting. I mean, my dad's family's Greek and my mum's family's from the northern parts of the UK. And God, I did like a DNA test recently and it turns
I've been
out
looking at those.
Yeah, the 23andMe thing.
Yeah.
It turns out that like most of my DNA, like hers, because she got it done as well, is like 90% of the population in Sweden and Denmark and Norway have that. And if you look at where her family's from, it's like it's so obvious that area was just raped and pillaged by Vikings for like centuries and therefore they basically became...
The seed was spread.
Nordic, yeah. Well, they basically became Nordic themselves genetically. So, I've always loved that sort of stuff.
I mean, so my Sven is obviously, you might be able to tell from his name, is Scandinavian. He's from Norway. His children are called Odin and Loki.
Oh, of course. He could have been Ukrainian, though, named like Sven.
But I've read fantasy novels for years. I'm a huge, huge fantasy. Even my tattoos on my arm are from a fantasy series that I read and loved called The Wheel of Time. The way that Mjolnir happened was we were talking about opening, we tried to look for a place to open Boilermaker House in Sydney, so a whiskey bar.
Okay.
And then we found this location, which is a heritage listed old tobacco factory.
Okay.
And just fell in love with the venue. But it just wouldn't suit the Boilermaker House brand. The license was quite limited. It's very, very segmented venue. It's not the big open kind of platform that Boilermaker House is. So we're like, right, love the location. Got to do something. Can't do Boilermaker House there. So Sven, I was traveling through Mexico at the time. And Sven sent me this email. I was like, what about we do this Viking bar? And I was like, I fucking love it. I showed my wife and she was like, oh, I don't know, really? And now she's like, I can't believe it's a thing. People love it.
It really is. I've always thought maybe you should be... it's a pity you don't have a TV there, but I feel like there could be some very special themed nights for people that are really into stuff like Game of Thrones and Vikings.
Oh, what are you talking about? We've done a Game of Thrones night before.
Have you?
Yeah.
Wow.
In Sydney.
I haven't seen this.
We were actually approached by, I think, a string quartet or a band of some sort, I can't remember, who do Game of Thrones songs. And they wanted to come in and play...
at that venue.
They did. They came in and they played acoustic Game of Thrones songs throughout a dinner service.
Wow.
There's also a set of or a Game of Thrones whiskeys being brought out by Diageo. Have you heard about these?
No.
So Diageo is bringing out a set of Game of Thrones whiskies. They've already brought out, is it the Johnny Walker, but the White Walker?
Okay, yeah, I've seen that.
But then they're bringing out their classic malt range, which is Lagavulin and Dalwhinnie, Clanleash, etc. I think there's like eight in total, but we're getting seven in Australia. And they're named after the houses of Game of Thrones.
Uh-huh.
And of course, there's like, a black bottle from Oberyn Distillery, which is the Night's Watch.
Yeah. That's pretty cool.
And we're launching, I don't know if I'm allowed to say, but we're launching.
We can cut it if not.
No, I'm sure it's going to be no big secret. We're launching those whiskies at Mjolnir in Sydney in a couple of months, just I think the week prior to the final season going to air.
That's so exciting because I've always thought HBO have been if Game of Thrones was a Disney brand, then fuck, we'd have merchandise galore. We'd have like you said, those whiskeys and stuff like that would have been out by season two.
Yeah.
Like we'd already be up to season 10 if it was a Disney brand.
Yeah, Disney know how to churn stuff out.
Oh man, they bought what was it? Lucasfilm Star Wars for I think $2 billion or something like either $2 to $4 billion. I think it was about $2 billion. And then in the second year of owning it, they've already made $4 billion out of it. So it's well and truly paid for.
Oh, I remember going to the shopping centers last Christmas or even the Christmas before, and you've got like a, you walk into the toy section and the entire toy section is about the same size as the Star Wars toy section. Like, it's just, it's crazy.
Does Mjolnir sell merch and stuff as well?
Well, we do indeed. Yeah. Did you know that we did?
Yeah. I was like sort of digging around, but like I've thought about that. Like, you know, you've obviously got this business model. And when I was reading the virtual thing, you covered like obviously like food and liquor. That's the obvious thing. But like the training or live events, and there was like two other things in there. But merchandise was, I think, one of the things you mentioned. It had me thinking about your brand and whether you, do you expand other brands like Boilermaker to include merchandise and going hard on that? Like, where does this all go?
Well, I'll tell you where it started, which is pretty cool, or pretty funny. It started, we wanted to do merchandise with Mjolnir as it opened. And then we had so many things getting stolen from us that we just started, right, we have to make a menu where people can buy it. Maybe if they can buy it.
Stolen as in people would just what, like take a coaster or?
No. Or like, what did we lose? We lost $2,500 worth of knives in one theft. Our dinner knives are basically like hunting knives that you get to choose to dine with. And they range from, they cost us between, over $100 up to $200 each.
Wow.
And they were going missing. We've got these cool little shot glasses, that we have our logo on, and they were going missing. Everything was going missing. So we're like, right, we need to make a menu where people can buy this stuff. So we did that and it started going well. And then we were like, wow, that's really going to up this. We saw like a lot of people come to Mjolnir for an experience, but they also come for celebrations. Like any one night, on a Friday night, we can have 30 birthday parties in Melbourne and 30 in Sydney. Mm-hmm. We can almost have 60 birthdays happening in just those two venues on a single night. So when you arrive and it's your birthday, it's your anniversary, we give you a birthday card. We give you an anniversary card, which is a pop-up Viking card. We also give you a small present, which is one of our glass horns. And what we found is a lot of people want to remember that night. So they'll buy a horn, a drinking horn, they'll buy one of our shot glasses, they'll buy some of our napkins that we've got on sale. And, you know, it just really took off. Now it's not a huge chunk of the business, but
it's a fledgling business.
It's definitely taken off like exactly how we wanted it to, which is even better.
How much is the drinking horn?
I think the small one's 45, large one 55, and that's a drinking horn with a stand with our logo kind of carved into the front of it.
Mjolnir is the only Melbourne venue of yours I haven't been to yet, and I'm thinking, fuck, I want to go like tomorrow night. I want to buy a fucking drinking horn. Put it right here.
You're going to go well next to your antler. Yeah, I was going to ask you if you've been in and took that from the wall. I think we lost one like it.
Nah. This is one of these weird things that my partner gave to me as a birthday gift when we first started dating. Like, I was maybe 19. I remember my cat, when I lived in my parents' house, my cat was obsessed with it. Like, she'd come up to it and like be smelling it. She didn't know whether to start chewing on it or whether to start rubbing up against it. But she was like really put off by it. It's one of the weirdest things. But she could obviously smell the dead animal that it came from unless they harvested it. But now there's a few things that people had in terms of the business itself. Stress. How do you manage that?
If you ask the people I work with, probably I manage it well. But if you ask my wife, I lose sleep sometimes.
Okay.
It's hard to switch off when you own six businesses and have 150 staff. There always seems to be something going on that you will take your mind off relaxing it. And but I've just had to learn. Like, I mean, reading books, exercising more these days, basically trying to exhaust myself so I can sleep. I've got a 10-month-year-old baby now.
Okay.
Thinking about her and getting home to play with her is a great way to kind of switch off. Definitely not opening your laptop if you want to go to sleep in the next 2 hours, because you might read an email that will make you mad or make you happy. Just something to trigger off a thought process to get you excited. Maybe even something really exciting that you can do the next day.
Okay. Having these little things that sort of set your day up right.
Oh, yeah. Look, exercising in the morning now is working. Like, I've tried things like meditation, but, you know, I'm not the best sleeper. It takes me ages to get to sleep. And if I wake up, I just start thinking about stuff again. So Switching off has been the big thing for me to work on.
Okay.
So I try to do a lot of things to switch off.
Yeah.
Or, you know, shut that laptop. Make sure when I, you know, do get home, it's like focusing on the family. But, you know, the laptop does come out. It's hard to switch off when it's your business kind of thing. So
it's very hard. I mean, I don't run a business of your size, but I run a business and I know what it's like. It sort of becomes like an engaging toy thing. Like, you just can't help yourself. You always got to go back to it.
Yeah. Oh, no. And owning your own business is extremely challenging, but also very rewarding. And that's where the playoff is, you know. You know, I've worked for people before and had amazing times working for extremely inspiring people and venues and so forth. Like you said before, I loved working at Black Pearl for a number of years and working for spirit companies and so forth. But still, I've never washed a rented car.
When it comes to the industry, you know, what's the thing that's first on your mind? Are you more worried? I mean, it seems obvious. Are you more worried about the customer, your competitors, or trends? Where are you always sort of looking?
We try to look at internally more. I think...
So, like, client habits and stuff like that.
Like, you know, staff and what we're doing. I think we try to focus on what we're doing. I'm not going to say we haven't kind of looked at trends around the globe and seen how they could integrate to the group. But I try... Like, if I go out there and follow four different whiskey bars, Instagram,
and just copy
and
them.
Facebook, you know, even if I don't want to copy what they're doing, when it comes to our brainstorming idea about our events and what we're going to be doing for Good Beer Week and so forth, it's just going to come out like, oh, that person's doing that, let's do something similar to that. So I tried actively not look too much what other people are doing to have original ideas.
What sort of seems like what you said with Sven and the idea of the Viking bar thing that he just said to you, it sort of seems like you're keeping in track of things that's going on, whether it's through social media, reading, whatever. And then you see a venue, you see a space, someone will come to you with an idea and it will just sort of crystallize in your head. Mm. It will sort of just come to you in a way. It's just that process and that repetition is needed.
It's also making sure that you know, you've got this well to draw upon when you get there. Like, you know, you might read heaps, you might, you know, listen to, you know, experts within the industry, you might listen to, you know, what other people are doing in and out of the industry and so forth. And then you just go, okay, you're forming opinions in your head. And then, but when it gets time to sit down and kind of brainstorm ideas or to come up with an idea, it's like you've got this well of stuff to draw upon rather than doing it the other way, saying, I've got to work on this idea. Let me go look for inspiration for that idea.
Yeah.
And then that's when I think you end up following trends and copying rather than kind of coming up with your own thing.
Yeah, and it comes across like that. You know, people can sort of see that, oh, it's very similar to this place because they think of that place and they think of this thing. What do you think is not changing in the industry? Like, what's never changed since you've been a part of it?
What's not changed?
Mm. You know, like people talk about... I thought it funny. I found an interview that you had in 2012 where you're talking about
2012.
Good quality pubs and dive bars, the American diner concept, which definitely became a thing. That was massive for a long time. And then South American spirits and influence, which is sort of still held there. I remember when people used to say like Mamacita was like the venue in Melbourne and it still exists. You know, Guzman and Gomez, it's not quite the ultimate venue, but people love going to get a burrito these days.
Guilty as charged.
Yeah, definitely guilty as charged. I guess it just had me thinking, like, what hasn't changed? Like, you know, we have all these different trends. You know, the Viking bar concept could not be a thing in 5 to 6 years from now. Maybe it is. Who knows?
How long was, like, Dracula's around? Not the way I thought. I think... You know what, since opening Mjolnir, definitely, like, you know, a lot of people before they come in go, wow, this is a themed restaurant, like, you know, that's going to be around for a little while, but let's try it out. They come in and they that's when they finally understand that the theming or kind of the inspiration sits in the background, but everything has to be about the quality of the food, quality of the drinks, and the quality of the service. Look, I'm not sure how to answer that question. Like, I don't get out as much as I once did. I think the things that haven't changed are, like, you know, maybe we should celebrate more the venues that have been around and doing it just great for so many years. Like, you know, all of the industry media is about the new hot place, which is not bad. It's worked for us opening venues. But, you know, the celebration of places like Gin Palace, Black Pearl, that have been doing it day in, day out, as good as it gets for 15 plus years. And, you know, those places deserve to be kind of continuously kind of celebrated rather than just everyone flock to the new place because it's new.
It's a good point. I really like that. I think that's one of the things. I just find myself going back repeatedly to, like, Lily Black's and Romeo Lane and Eau de Vie, and love going back to Supper Club.
Mm. Which is, as we've been talking about this, the one name that was sticking out in my head that I didn't mention as well. The Supper Club's just been doing it. I think it must be almost 20 years they've been
there. It's so long.
Yeah.
So long. Before we jump into some quick, short questions, what's the trend? One of the questions is, what's the trend that you'd like to see go away? What's the thing that you really dislike? Lemon lime bitters?
Don't mind the lemon lime bitters. Trend that I'd like to see go away. Whoa. Bitching about the industry, staff that bitch about the industry. Is that a trend? I'm not sure.
It's definitely a
look,
theme.
I think the trend, if I can't pinpoint one, but the trends that probably need to go away are probably also inspiring, like, the trends that need to come.
Yeah.
So I think it's just all of circle. You know, Mexican restaurants pop up like a mad, you know, like mad in Melbourne, and then, you know, there's too many Mexican restaurants, so we might see some Croatian restaurants, like, you know what I mean? So, like, I think that the trends that probably become overpopulated and need to go away then push new ones forward, and that's the great circle, the cycle of the hospitality industry.
Love to see a Croatian restaurant. Huh? Yeah. I remember when we were in Croatia, it's one of those things that sort of that part of the Mediterranean that doesn't get a good look. Yeah.
I've been to Split and Dubrovnik.
Have you? Yeah. My very close family friend, we've traveled a lot around the Mediterranean with, we were actually in Turkey, sort of south of Turkey on a boat with them. And I was in Europe with my partner in 2012 for a long, long time, about 6-7 months. And he just gave us the keys to his house. He bought like an old shack outside of Split. The island's called Štramorska. It's just like no tourists go there. There's no reason to go there.
Beautiful part of the earth.
Beautiful place. And I reckon there's maybe like 100 people that live on the island. And it has two restaurants. And I remember when we stopped in Zagreb and I thought, fuck, this food is just so underrated. Like, the food that we went to and just your average restaurant was amazing. Like, just that sort of, you know, squid and, you know, the use of squid ink in fucking everything. And then we went to Štramorska and just, it was so simple and so nice.
We'll have
nice.
To look up if there's Croatian restaurants.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure I've seen one or two, but not like, you know, it's never been a trend, I don't think. All right. Some short, fast questions for you. What does your morning routine look like?
Morning routine lately has been waking up super early.
Okay.
What
time?
In the last couple of weeks, and I'll say this is quite recent, the last couple of months, between 5 and 6.
Okay.
Either go to the gym or go to the basketball court or just get into work early.
Okay.
Pretty light on the whole breakfast scene. I don't usually do a big breakfast. I've got a 10-month little baby girl, and I've actually been getting up, I think, before her. So I'm usually out of the house before she goes, before she wakes up.
Yeah.
And then pretty much into work, okay. Into work after the gym or the basketball court.
And what about your evening routine? What does that look like?
Evening routine's changed since Aurora's come along. I used to kind of just stay in the city and work until, you know, 7, 8, whenever it was needed. Mm-hmm. Now I pretty much leave the city at 5 o'clock on the dot, get home, play with Aurora until she falls asleep at about 6 or 7. Mm-hmm. If I'm still busy, the laptop will come out again.
Yeah.
Or I'll kind of hang out with my wife and make some dinner or do something pretty chilled.
Chill for the rest of the night.
Yeah.
Have you found that since having a child that your night's actually a lot more relaxed now?
Uh-huh. relaxed and the bedtime has massively changed. If I could go back, you know, and tell Greg Sanderson 10 years ago that you'd be like looking to go to bed at like 9:30, 10 o'clock, I'd slap myself in the face or tell him I'm joking.
What would it have been in the peak of like starting O to V, like 3 a.m., 4 a.m.?
No, we'd usually finish about 3. Well, the venue closed at 1. By the time the place was clean and the tills were counted and you'd had a knockoff drink, it was 3 or just before 3. Then it was quick one at Lily Black's on the way home and kind of you'd get to sleep about 4:30 and then wake up and start doing it again.
And what time would you wake up?
At O to V, I'd be back in the city before like 9:30 in the morning.
Jesus. 9:30. Yeah, 10. I remember reading there was an interview in 2017 with your Sydney bar manager. And it just made me remember, like, the hours in hospitality are absolutely brutal and completely
different.
Who's
that, Russ?
I think so. He's a hard worker. Best purchase under $200.
Oh, best purchase under $200. Does it have to be me or could my wife bought it?
Anything at all.
Books. I just love books.
Yeah.
All my books are under $200. I currently just reading a fantasy novel series and takes, you know, I love reading fantasy purely because if you read a book like, you know, say Scar Tissue or something like that, you're like, oh, you think about your vices and you think about, oh God, I'm similar to, oh God, you know, but you read a fantasy novel and you really can't relate to some guy who's got magic powers and like, you know.
Yeah, it's a bit of escapism.
So it's a escapism, but I'd say, or the books that I buy are my best purchases because they're hours and hours and hours of escapism.
It's so good. I love reading. I read for about an hour a night to get me to fall asleep as well. So what's the name of that series?
The one I'm currently reading, yeah. Mistborn.
Okay. What else? If you could have a billboard anywhere in Australia, where would it be, first of all? And then what would it say?
Where would it be? Oh man, if Bill wouldn't have my face on it, I'd like to walk past it every morning. So just to give myself a nod and check myself and go, why the hell do you have your safe face on a billboard? I think it's the comment that I said earlier. Like it'd say something about grit and just encourage people to not give up and to always put in their hardest, not just in like spurts, but just like constant drive. And I think that's, you know, a great bit of advice to anyone that kind of, you know, wants to be successful in their own fields, or just don't forget that, you know, it doesn't happen overnight. You know, that overnight success story took years and years of grit, of just like hard work from the moment you wake up
to
the moment
you
go to sleep. So something reminding people about, you know, success is, you know, it requires a lot of work, yeah. Something like that.
Look, thank you so much for doing this. I know you've got a busy life. Busy schedule. Where can people find you on social media, mm-hmm. or the business? Where should they be looking?
We've just, the Speakeasy Group's just launched its first group webpage. Okay. So it's got information on all of our venues. It's also got my contact details on there as well. So I think it's just www.speakeasygroup.com.au. Mm-hmm. And yeah, all the details are on there. Venues, anything else you want to find out. As you said before, we're doing an equity raise. If you're keen to...
That's right.
If you're keen to own your own chunk of a growing hospitality group, it's on the virtual crowdfunding equity raising website.
Yeah, we'll make sure we link all of that, plus the website and social media pages, to make sure people can find you guys. I think a lot of people local in Melbourne who listen will have heard of O to V, and if not, they should go check it out. I think for the American listeners who plan to come to Australia, they should definitely at least visit one of the venues.
You're going to have to follow your Google Maps because there's no signs on any of our doors, hence yeah. The name Speakeasy Group.
I've always thought about that. Like, do you do that on purpose?
Of course. If you go past Boilermaker House, so Boilermaker House is on a main street with a glass shop frontage. So you're like, well, this is not us. So we actually sunk the entry a few meters behind the glass doors. So you open the glass doors and then there's just a wall with no, once again.
It's pretty cool. Like, O to V is really hard. I regularly walk home down that laneway because mm-hmm. I work not far from there. And it's so funny seeing people like just with their phone, they're just like, and they're like outside the door, and I'm like, are you looking for O2V? And I'm like, they're like, yeah. And I said, that's the bell.
We've definitely in the early days when people were trying to find us, now a lot of people know where we are. I remember getting phone calls, like people were like, look, I know things are hard to fucking find in Melbourne, but this is just fucking ridiculous. Where the hell are you guys?
Love it. Yeah. Look, Greg, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you. Been a pleasure.
Thank you for making it to the end. Before you run off, we need your help to grow this audience. Subscribe on your podcast app. Subscribing will give you priority access and help your fellow-minded listeners find Uncommon, or consider sharing this with a friend who you think would enjoy these sorts of episodes, and this will go a very, very long way in helping us build the audience. Don't forget to like us on Facebook and Twitter, or consider subscribing on YouTube as well. You just need to search for Neural, NeurAlle, or consider following us on Instagram as well by searching Uncommon, UncommoN. But until next time, thank you so much for listening. This podcast is brought to you by Neural Media. Are you an entrepreneur or maybe a marketer who wants to grow their business through content production? Maybe you're sick of dealing with agencies or want an outsourced solution that actually fits a budget? Well, Neural Media, our business, can help you with simple and affordable content production, saving you time and money by taking away that pain of producing the content. If you want to learn more, just head to neural.com/media, which is NeurAlle.com/media. Play around with our pricing. Have a look at all the different options that you have. Request or consider requesting a callback from me personally. If you have a friend that runs a business or is a marketer, do send them our way. It will help us keep the lights on and producing more juicy content. Listeners to this show receive a special discount by using the promo code UNCOMMON. If you want to learn yourself as to how to create content, maybe you want to make a podcast or your very own video, just download our free series on how to create a podcast and video at the very bottom of neural.com/media.